Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, September 17th, 2011. I'm Marcia Mary Baker. Our headline topic for today is 9/11, 10 years later. Of course, we refer to what a week ago was the 10th anniversary of the attack on the United States that occurred in September 11th, 2001, known as 9/11 since. And we in particular are referring to a LaRouche Political Action Committee video feature that was issued 1 week ago exactly on the day of September 11th. And it is beyond a documentary about what's involved in that original attack. It is a strategic intervention into our situation today, which is at a moment of historic crisis. Now, I'm very glad to have live with me in the studio today, Jeffrey Steinberg. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Marsh.
And Jeff, as you know, is who does many things. He's our counterintelligence editor for EIR, EIR Online. And we were hoping to have with us Leandra Bernstein, who is unable to be here. A situation has come up for her and is unable to join us today. Jeff and Leandra have spoken earlier today. But Leandra and Chris Yaditz, a colleague of hers with LPAC TV, actually wrote and produced this 9/11, 10 years later, video feature. And collaborating on all the counterintelligence, and you'll see him speaking on this, is Jeffrey Steinberg and others of EIR. So that is what we're going to be discussing, many aspects of what was put out, and as I say, this strategic intervention with Jeff. But before we do that, what I think is Jeff, who has been meeting with Mr. LaRouche and other staff today on breaking developments over this weekend and over the course of the week, I think you might fill us in on aspects of this situation.
Well, we had a lengthy discussion, a group of us, with both Mr. LaRouche and his wife Helga this morning. And today should be considered a day of celebration because we've accomplished something very dramatic. And when I say we, I mean quite literally the LaRouche political movement, particularly in the United States. It's a double witching hour for the Obama administration. Yesterday, as many of you probably already are aware, Secretary of Treasury Geithner went over to Europe. He was in Poland as a self-invited guest, kind of bullied his way into the party of the European finance ministers from all 27 of the European Union countries. And Geithner went over there presumptuously to dictate terms of a bailout for the Europeans. And what he proposed was a combination of more Fed and Treasury bailout money going to the European banks, especially the Rothschild InterAlpha Banking Group, which is hopelessly bankrupt. But he also was proposing that the Europeans adopt the identical insane policy that had been adopted in September of 2008 around the so-called Lehman Brothers crisis, which was a hyperinflationary bailout by the Fed and Treasury here. We know from Neil Barofsky, who was the inspector general of the TARP program, that as much as $23.7 trillion in American taxpayers' money went to bail out the too-big-to-fail U.S. and European banks. And frankly, that whole episode bankrupted the United States and did nothing to avoid the fact that those banks still to this day remain hopelessly bankrupt. So when Geithner showed up in Europe to deliver this message, telling them that they better ram through the European Financial Stability Fund, a 440 billion euro bailout fund modeled on the TARP program in the U.S. But Geithner said, do what we did here. Leverage those funds, and you will have, in effect, a 10-to-1 leverage and over 4 trillion euro to cover the bailout of Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and basically hold back the floodgates on Spain and Italy, which are the two really, you know, gigantic European economies that are also ready to basically face a sovereign debt blowout. Now, what happened in Poland is that basically Geithner was told to go to hell. The Europeans, a number of the leading finance ministers, Germany, Austria in particular, they basically said no. And in fact, who the hell are you to come over here and try to peddle a policy that has made the United States a bankrupt basket case? So it was a big defeat for the Obama administration, for Wall Street, and for the city of London. And simultaneous to that, the revolt coming from within the Democratic Party against President Obama and his policies also reached a breakpoint. And what Mr. LaRouche said today is Obama is finished. He will probably go psychologically over the edge in some dramatic way. And whereas even just a few weeks or so ago, many people scoffed at the idea that Obama could be removed from office anytime prior to the 2012 general elections. Now it's looking like a very, very real proposition. You had late last week a flurry of attacks on Obama, the most prominent one coming from James Carville, who posted something on CNN on midweek and basically said, Mr. President, there's only one word of advice I can give you, and that word is panic. And he said, the Obama reelection is hopelessly doomed unless he does something really dramatic, meaning start out firing your entire team, and then indict, by which he means get Geithner out of there and lift the block on criminal prosecutions of the Wall Street criminals. He said, if you want to win, you're going to have to panic, fire, and indict. And as we well know, those are three things that are not in Obama's vocabulary. Sure, he'll panic. But his panic will take the form of an Emperor Nero-type narcissist freakout. There's already an investigation ongoing by the New York Times and other, quote, establishment media looking into the fact that Obama is suffering from clinical depression on top of his narcissism. That is a deadly combination. And for people who want to get a more in-depth picture of Obama's mental breakdown, then go to the LaRouche Pack website, where there is a very recent interview with Dr. Sam Vaknin, who wrote a very famous book on narcissism called Malignant Self-Love. And he gave an interview to LPAC TV's Brent Bedford, in which he discussed Obama's deteriorating condition. Now, to understand the significance of what's going on with Obama, and there are demands out there publicly coming from leading Democrats, not Republicans, that Obama has to fire Bill Daley, has to fire Tim Geithner, and also fire Eric Holder for having gone along with Geithner's insistence that Wall Street be given a free get-out-of-jail pass, and that there have been no indictments despite massive criminality that's been proven between the Levin Coburn report, the Angelides report, the revelations coming out of the Fed documents ordered by Senator Bernie Sanders and coming out of the Bloomberg Fox TV civil lawsuit. So Obama is doomed, and Geithner got his head handed to him in Europe. And Obama got the message from the Democrats that it's time to totally clean house or you're finished. And in fact, the reality is that the person who really has to go right away is Obama himself. But again, to understand the strategic significance of this, you really have to go back to April of 2009, when Lyndon LaRouche gave an international webcast, widely circulated at the time and referenced many times since then, basically identifying clinically Obama's neurocomplex, his narcissist problem. And it was in that context that we first gave Obama the Hitler mustache when he began pushing for a replica of Hitler's T4 euthanasia policy under the guise of a health care reform bill. Now, one other element of this picture to sort of round it out, and then if you've got any other thoughts or questions, Marsh. Today's New York Times has the results of their latest polling data on Obama, and the obvious conclusion is that support for Obama is collapsing at a breathtaking rate. In fact, after he delivered his so-called big jobs speech before a joint session of Congress a little over a week ago, his poll numbers crashed by another 4%. But most dramatic in this New York Times poll is the fact that 80% of the people who were asked said that we must immediately go to an urgent program of investment in infrastructure for job creation and to rebuild our economy. Now, this is a mood that has been building, that's been latent in the American people. We saw it dramatically first in August of 2009, when thousands of people turned out for town hall meetings by members of Congress and practically ran them out of town on a rail in opposition to Obamacare. But now we're seeing a much more developed and much more conscious reflection of that impulse, and people now have come up with an idea of what they want. It's the return to the FDR-JFK tradition. And this has been the driving idea behind all of the LaRouche PAC organizing around the country. And we're actually seeing the fruits of that. People are now demonstrating that not only do they have an idea of what they don't want, they now have an idea of what they want. And this is a tremendous moment of opportunity. And as I say, it was a double witching hour for Obama between Geithner's failure in Europe and the further visible disintegration of the Obama presidency here on the home front, with a full-scale revolt underway coming from Democrats.
Right. Well, two things, and then we'll go into some on 9/11. I mean, it's all part of the context, the particular moment we're in. But when you said it's a time that we should celebrate the accomplishment of creating this potential and creating this for really a drastic policy shift towards the good, you may want to stress that again, is that we're the leadership now as the LaRouche Political Action Committee is going. And the second part of that question is, There are leading circles. Mr. Putin is doing certain things in Russia. There's collaboration between Russia and China on new levels of meetings, commitments. And so just say something about
that.
In terms of the moment we are now pushing to take advantage of.
Good. Well, let me address it in two aspects. Number one, as many listeners are probably aware, about a month ago, Mr. LaRouche laid out a 7-point program for avoiding a dark age and launching a global economic recovery. It starts here in the United States because here, this is the unavoidable starting point. Got to get rid of Obama. And now we see significant movement in that direction. And once Obama is out, we immediately move to implement Glass-Steagall right away, no delay whatsoever. And then having basically removed $17 trillion in gambling debt from the backs of American taxpayers, we go back to a credit system and begin issuing government credit, long-term, low-interest credits for earmarked development projects starting with the North American Water and Power Alliance. Having done that, you now have the preconditions for a three-way global alliance between the United States, Russia, and China. The impulse is already there. We see it clearly in Russia and in China as well. But as Mr. LaRouche emphasized in the discussions this morning, neither Russia nor China, and not even Russia and China alone in combination, can pull the world out of this trajectory towards a dark age. But a U.S.-Russia-China combination post-Obama and with Glass-Steagall and a return to a credit system here in the United States, that same policy is immediately adopted in treaty agreement with Russia and China. And these three leading world powers who think globally, who think strategically, put together the core of a global recovery plan and an alliance for that. India will join immediately. But what Mr. LaRouche emphasized is at this point, because you've got a problem in India, which is that the population itself has been so victimized by the British colonial experience that they're not ready yet to break out. And if you tried to go with a four-power agreement at this moment, when you've got to move with lightning speed, India would be a drag and it wouldn't work. But once you get a deal between the U.S., Russia, and China, India is immediately on board, and many, many other leading countries around the world will jump on board instantly. So this is the strategy. This is how we're going to avoid a plunge into a civilizational dark age that may take us three generations, if we're lucky, to slug our way out of. We've got an opportunity now with the collapse of the Obama British combination. The Brits took a gigantic hit when Geithner failed in Poland. And in fact, the general sense among the Europeans is that you should raise funds through a transaction tax on the banks. And of course, 70% of those transactions in Europe take place in London. So it's a big hit against the Brits. So this U.S.-Russia-China alliance around a reinstatement of a credit system based on a return to a Bretton Woods kind of fixed exchange rate, and then agreement by treaty arrangement on a series of major development projects, the Eurasian land bridge, the Bering Straits tunnel linking to the Western Hemisphere, NAWAPA, and projects of a similar nature in Africa and in many other parts of the globe. This is the way to go. And it can be done. You can have a turnaround as dramatic as the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. We're in one of those kinds of moments again.
Yeah, before we transition, although it's the same thing, but to some of the historical things people really need to know or review in their minds behind what's called the 9/11 attack, it's what you say over the last week to 10 days is so, in a way you could say in the transatlantic area, the political environment is in a way super saturated with potential in the United States to go for Glass-Steagall, yet more. I think there are now 40 co-sponsors, besides other commitments to Marcy Kaptur's H.R. 1489 that would reinstate Glass-Steagall. But there are more regions of the country who express support through their trade union or through another organization or through a meeting. And in Europe, there is a dynamic of more inclination to let's have a national vote. There are calls for, Helga Zeplerush put out a call, put this policy of ending the euro,
exactly.
It's one way to put it, to a vote, and had has tremendous interest developing. There was a new election September 15, and the government of 10 years was voted out in Denmark, and the new prime minister there, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, has said there shouldn't be supermarkets of banks. You should break apart the supermarket. So there's a lot of latent inclination.
By the way, I should mention one other thing that was another break point on the U.S. side. I neglected to mention it before. The Brooklyn special election for the House seat vacated by Wiener was a stunning, stunning repudiation of Obama from Democrats. You're talking about a congressional district in Brooklyn that has been solid Democratic district for almost 100 years. The Republican candidate who won by 54% to 46%, a substantial victory, was defeated the last time around by Wiener by a 28% margin. So you've got like a swing of literally one-third of the vote, and it was a willful act of punishment of Obama defeating a Democratic candidate. It wasn't about Israel and the Middle East per se, because the Democratic candidate is an Orthodox Jew. It was not the issue. It was a total repudiation of Obama on the part of one of the most overwhelming Democrat constituent congressional districts in the United States. And the message is very clear. If Obama can't win in Brooklyn, he can't win anywhere. He's doomed. He's finished. And so this was the other part of this pattern of developments that took place over the last week that is really quite stunning.
Yeah, and we're going to say for another show, we've had people on, Jeff, in recent weeks on the disaster circumstances of our nation in terms of the extreme weather, floods,
right,
drought, fires. But the Obama administration and the man himself in the White House, who's completely oblivious to this, mm-hmm, is part of this a potential where, unfortunately, people are being harmed every hour by not having relief.
Right.
But politically, it's another manifestation of what do you expect? This guy is, we got to get him out of there.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that does not mean that Rick Perry should come in on a white horse, because, no, you know, the suffering that's going on in Texas right now, we've been just looking into the scale back of investment in basic firefighting capabilities and similar things.
Perry did it
off
for
the
2 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, he said we have to get, we'll just scale back the firefighting capability.
Right.
So a combination of the Rick Perry, the Rand Paul, the Ron Paul, and so forth outlook with Obama and the Wall Street behind it,
exactly,
is now in front of everyone that we can get rid of it.
Right, exactly. And Perry's energy policy is basically an electric chair in every pot.
Oh, gosh. That's right. That's right. So, well, then let me do this, because you're – again, we have Jeff here, especially both on breaking developments, but his work on this special LaRouche LPAC video. It's about 50 minutes. It's dynamite. I won't say it's a bombshell. Nuts. The thing is, one thing there in this, Jeff, is that it was in summer 2007 that Mr. LaRouche said at an international webcast, okay, folks, this is it. The whole financial system is unraveling now. It's not pending. It is underway. And that, fast forward 4 years now, and now we have a complete collapse.
Right.
That's what we have. Okay. But, you know, it was your video brought out that it was that same pronouncement by Lynn, which was absolutely vindicated. I mean, it was right at the time, that he said, and be clear, we've been living under what he called, quote, a 9/11 system. And he said that at the time, saying that we've had years of what, well, I'm saying this now, a kind of imposed government rule by emergency decree in the country, getting progressively more intense or not, mm-hmm. as you may describe, but a kind of rule by emergency powers instead of by Republican government principle.
Right.
And so he warned of both at the same time. We need emergency action on the economy, and we want people to recognize that the international financial powers that be behind, you mentioned the Rothschild Interalpha banking networks, the select Wall Street London money axis, that they, as their system came to an end, would be resorting to the kind of high-level dirty tricks that's to say the least of it, that brought us the 9/11 attacks. And so would you kind of summarize, in other words, and then we can get into some nitty-gritty as you want, the fact that that's a key part of the context you were bringing out, that people have
sure.
to understand.
Well, look, go back to January of 2001, days, if not weeks, before the Bush-Cheney inauguration. Through his spokeswoman, Deborah Hananya Freeman, Lyndon LaRouche delivered testimony opposing the confirmation of John Ashcroft as Attorney General. And what he said in those remarks that were conveyed as part of Debbie's testimony was that the character of the Bush administration was that they would look for the first opportunity for a Reichstag fire type incident to impose dictatorship. Of course, in February of 1933, Hitler declared a dictatorship after the Reichstag, the German parliament, was set on fire. And a month later, the parliament capitulated to the Enabling Act, which effectively eliminated political parties and gave Hitler a dictatorship that was only ended by the defeat of the Nazis in World War II. And so LaRouche warned about that 9 months before the 9/11 attacks. And so he had a sense, he made a forecast about the future, not based on some inside information or leaks, or he was not privy to any details of some plotting of a 9/11 attack. He saw the character of the administration, and he made a forecast about the future based on an insight into that character. And on September 11th, 2001, that forecast was proven absolutely accurate. Immediately after the attacks, Obama and Cheney moved to establish dictatorial powers. They were rebuffed slightly by Congress. They wanted an authorization for a global permanent war, not action in Afghanistan. So it took them a little bit of time to regroup and reprogram their war plans after Afghanistan to invade Iraq, which, of course, happened in March 2003. In the meantime, we know that fundamental constitutional protections were eroded. There was a massive system of spying on American citizens. The executive branch seized unitary executive powers. And so the things that LaRouche warned about established a pattern of government outside the framework of our Constitution that we're to a very large extent still living under today. In fact, a big part of the mandate for Obama was that people naively believed that he was actually genuine in campaigning for a rollback of the unitary executive powers of Bush and Cheney. He came into office, and we've got not only a continuation, but a further augmentation of the drive for dictatorial powers. And, of course, because of the economic crisis and a variety of other things, those efforts are blowing up in Obama's face right now, as we were just discussing. So that was the nature of what happened, what the 9/11 operation was really all about. It was a move to establish a dictatorial system to rip up the U.S. Constitution and to use the horrifying events of 9/11 to convince people that this was in their interests, to throw away 200-plus years of constitutional republic.
Right. And now, so now to the character of the incidents of that day, the assault itself and so forth, you, in this composition that you and Leandra Christiadis and others did, you go back and lay out the whole, you don't go back with a couple of hundred years of the British East India Company, although feel free to talk about that. But you go back to the 1979, to one thing that's in the minds of a lot of our listeners, the older ones, the way in which there was the creation of what ended up with 90,000 Soviet troops in Afghanistan. In other words, creating a war right. zone, a particular location in Afghanistan. So there were networks involved in that, and these networks continue. They had predecessors, and they mm-hmm. have successors. And so 9/11 is part of that entire kind of great game.
That's right. Look, the war was begun. It didn't start with the Soviet invasion on Christmas Eve of 1979. It actually started much earlier. It started really with the deployment of Dr. Bernard Lewis to the United States, a high-level British intelligence operative who immediately glommed onto Zbigniew Brzezinski right after the Carter administration came in, knowing that Brzezinski had an obsessive hatred of the Soviet Union. And so what Bernard Lewis sold was a policy that was known as the Arc of Crisis. And what he said is, let's promote Islamic fundamentalism all across the southern tier of the Soviet Union, from the Caucasus region in the west, all across Central Asia, practically to the Pacific coast. And so those operations were initiated. You had in February of 1979 the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Soon after that, a war began between Iran and Iraq. And then Christmas 1979, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in response to the fact that there were already covert operations being conducted by what came to be known as the Afghan Mujahideen, who were financed primarily by a program later initiated under the name Al-Yamama. But initially you had Saudi, British, and American covert funding on a kind of an ad hoc basis, which later was consolidated with the oil for arms deal between Britain and Saudi Arabia, known as Al-Yamama. That began in 1985. And over the course of the next decades, it still continues to this day. Under the Al-Yamama program, hundreds of billions of dollars were siphoned off through the spot market sale of Saudi oil. And those funds went into a covert action program that funded, among other things, the Afghan Mujahideen. Now, to understand Al-Qaeda and the role of Osama bin Laden, there's one thing that you've got to really understand. Saudi Arabia was established as an alliance, as a political deal between the House of Saud and the fundamentalist Wahhabi clergy of Saudi Arabia. And to this very day, those are the two pillars of power, completely intertwined and interdependent, that run Saudi Arabia.
You're talking about the time period in the
started 18th century.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, even earlier.
Okay.
Started in the 18th century, and so this is an arrangement that's been going on for 300 years plus.
Mm-hmm.
And within that structure, one of the families that rose to great wealth and prominence was the Bin Laden family. Mohammed Bin Laden, the father of Osama, was originally a Yemeni who crossed into Saudi Arabia, started out as a construction worker, and through a lot of diligence, hard work, emerged as one of the leading construction magnates in the kingdom, and became, in effect, the preferred big construction company for some of the most important projects sponsored by the Saudi royal family with the oil money, but also through the religious hierarchy, the Bin Laden Construction Company was given the contract to renovate the three holiest sites of Islam, the mosques in Mecca and Medina, and then the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. So in other words, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more powerful and prestigious political family enjoying the patronage of both the House of Saud and the Wahhabi clergy at the very top. So the idea that Osama bin Laden was somehow or other a rogue is preposterous. It's like the old wealthy oligarchical families in South America. Traditionally, one son would go into the government, one into the military, and one would become a communist revolutionary, but it was all in the family. So when the Saudis became deeply involved early on in the Afghan Mujahideen operation, when no member of the royal family was ready to step forward to be the leader of the Saudi presence in this Afghan operation, they turned and instead chose Osama bin Laden. He was handpicked by a man named Bahal, who was his high school science teacher or tutor, who went on to become the chief of staff to the head of Saudi intelligence, Prince Turki bin Faisal. So in other words, coming from the bin Laden family, Osama bin Laden was handpicked as an asset of the Saudi participation in the whole Afghan operation. And so Al-Qaeda was, from the very outset, a project of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. There was a brief period of time during the American military occupation of Saudi Arabia when there were hundreds of thousands of American troops around the time of Desert Storm, where bin Laden was protesting against that. But that issue was resolved fairly quickly. And in fact, Osama bin Laden's ties to Saudi intelligence remained a vibrant and dominant factor. And of course, the Saudis played a pivotal role in Pakistan, particularly with the Pakistan military and the inter-service intelligence, their equivalent of CIA military intelligence kind of rolled into one. So the real story of 9/11 is that you had a Saudi-sponsored and Anglo-Saudi-financed operation that was targeted at the United States. And the consequences of the attacks of 9/11 were to give the Bush-Cheney administration exactly the opportunity, the Reichstag fire moment, that LaRouche warned about. Now, that's not to say that George Bush or even Dick Cheney had a clue about what was going to happen, but it is to say that the Anglo-Saudi apparatus, which had a very effective penetration of the United States, was here on the ground and in a position to carry out this operation. And the Bush-Cheney crowd seized the moment to establish this post-constitutional dictatorial set of structures.
Right. Now, let me ask you this. There are two things that come up here. One thing is, if you want to say more or not, that's okay. But people should know to watch this video more than once and see some of the hardcore cold facts that Leandra and all of you documented about the actual checks and where they were drawn on. Riggs Bank in Washington, D.C., they went to people who based in California, Saudis, who then set up two of the 17 people involved right. in the hit operation. They show up else. Rather than summarize here, I'm just saying that's how explicit, and you might want to characterize all that. And number two, on the investigation of this, more is coming out now. We certainly want you to say about that.
Right. Former Senator Bob Graham, a Democrat from Florida, he was governor of Florida at one point. He and Senator Richard Shelby, who's still in the Senate, is a Republican from Alabama, they co-chaired the joint congressional investigation into 9/11 that preceded the work of the 9/11 Commission. And recently, Senator Graham has come out with a book in which is a novel, because, as he said, the things that he knows from the investigation can't be told as nonfiction because there's many classified details. But he is calling for a new 9/11 investigation. And new details have just come out in the last several days. It turns out that there was a very prominent and wealthy Saudi family that had a mansion in southern Florida, had businesses in the United States, lived in southern Florida, that members of that family were in close contact with two at least of the 9/11 hijackers, including the leader of the whole operation. And all of this occurred right under the noses of American officials at the time. In fact, this Saudi family in southern Florida left the country, left their mansion behind, fully furnished, food in the refrigerator. They left the country just several days before the 9/11 attacks. And they were in regular, frequent contact with Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, the guy who was the team leader for the operation of the 19 hijackers in the United States. So this parallels the fact that two Saudi intelligence officers, Osama Baznan and Omar al-Bayoumi, were the handlers of two of the West Coast-based 9/11 hijackers. And so you've got a paper trail of money literally going through the Saudi embassy bank accounts in Washington, D.C., into the hands of two of the West Coast hijackers. And Senator Graham has basically said that this was far more exemplary of the whole operation. He said, in my view, this was in a recent interview, I believe, in Salon magazine. He said, in my view, all 19 of the hijackers were being protected and given backing from Saudi government intelligence officers. And there is no way that this was innocent or accidental.
Right. And the thing is that your video also points out that when there was a complete a cessation of any flights in the skies, a plane full of at least 100 Saudi nationals took off.
Including members of the bin Laden family.
And, yeah, I remember both of us, of course, are here within the range of when the Pentagon was attacked, and we
Absolutely.
Heard at the moment.
Yeah.
And the next thing is, the at the time, the head of MI5 and MI6 showed up under the same circumstances.
Right. At a time that no flights were coming into or leaving the United States. In fact, there was a complete ban on civil aviation over the entire United States territory.
Right. So let me interject two questions here from Gerald in California, because one thing is that this is glaring, what Bob Graham is bringing out, what you've all summarized so far. What about, he's asking about foreign attention to it. Surely other places and other individuals who've experienced this in Italy or Europe or somewhere and mentioned certain cases have insight into this. Have they spoken out in recent years or right now? And secondly, isn't it the case there's been a kind of diversion operation, presumably by the same networks, encouraging a conspirophilia to go in the wrong directions? Instead of looking at this, they're looking at mechanics of how the towers came down,
exactly.
Not the strategic context in which who gains.
Exactly. I mean, you're going to always get, look, if you're running a major covert operation, you're always going to have a cover-up in place. And this is no exception. But I think there's another point, which is that we had a very significant series of follow-on events. You had the subway bombings in London. You had the big attacks on a series of trains in Spain on the eve of Spanish elections. And then, of course, in November of 2008, you had the major three-day terrorist commando assault on the Indian financial capital of Mumbai. And so what we know from some long-standing contacts in the U.S. intelligence community, some of whom have been in close working relationship with Mr. LaRouche going back to the 1970s when he intervened against the Trilateral Commission Jimmy Carter-Brzezinski government, and who collaborated closely with Mr. LaRouche around the Strategic Defense Initiative. We got indication from some of those long-standing contacts immediately after 9/11 that the full investigation into the events of 9/11 would be going on for decades. You really are going through a process of peeling layers of a very big onion. And after the Mumbai attacks in particular, because of the convergence of networks, and because that attack was staged out of Pakistani territory involving some of the same support networks and finance networks as the 9/11 attacks, these investigations basically overlapped and areas of intersection became points of special interest. And so what we have now is if you take the 9/11 operation and really honestly look at all of the evidence and then overlap that with the evidence that you've got coming out of the Mumbai attacks, what you have is an Anglo-Saudi apparatus of fundamentalists, of intelligence operatives, of people involved deeply in the international drug trade.
And the money changing in the Persian Gulf.
Exactly.
Points, that, would
exactly.
you say? In,
yeah, the
Kuwait,
architect, one of the key architects of the Mumbai attacks was a gangster based in Mumbai for many years named Dawood Ibrahim, who left Mumbai, is now in Karachi, Pakistan, closely tied to the Islamist networks, closely tied to the drug trade coming out of Afghanistan. And he was an expert money launderer going back when he was a gold smuggler in Mumbai decades ago. And he has a whole banking and money laundering infrastructure in place in Dubai and in other parts of the world. So you have this infrastructure. It's almost like a cookie cutter model that you have these capabilities that represent a merger of political radicalism, organized crime, in some cases, religious fundamentalist networks, who are all morphing together. Their character itself is changing, but they represent a capability, and it overlaps precisely with what we've come to describe as the al-Yamama apparatus, which itself is a nest of offshore intelligence slush funds financing criminal activities, financing terrorism, asymmetric warfare. And in every instance where you've got a major theater of operation of these kinds of things, you have drugs. Remember, during Vietnam, the big heroin-producing, opium-producing region of the world was the Golden Triangle, right there adjacent to the Indochina war zone. When that war ended, it's remarkable that within a matter of a few short years, the major opium production area of the world shifted to the Golden Crescent region of Afghanistan, Pakistan, parts of Iran, where, again, a war erupted that's now been going on for more than 30 years.
Right. So you, as you say, you could call it the opium war type policy, the
Absolutely.
Great game type policy. You see the geography shift.
Right.
But the principle underlying it all is clear. And in fact, that brings me to something you, in your discussions that Leander and Chris Yaditz put in the video, at some point you refer to all this. This is, you didn't say it, but the viewer sees this is wicked. This is completely undermining the whole system of nations. It's completely treasonous to the United States. These penetration operations where you get a evil type like Bernard Lewis sneaking around institutions. And so this is bad, but you said, you know, it's even deeper and darker. That there's a kind of principle of some people are worth something and others aren't. That's coming out of London, but it has roots elsewhere in Venice.
Sure.
And that's you made that point. And one thing that underscores it, I'd like people to make sure and look at the next issue of EIR online, because our editor-in-chief, Nancy Spanis, has written about this. The World Wildlife Fund, this is not extraneous, is going to get a new head. It's going to be Prince Charles, coming right after his father, who
right.
exemplifies just what you said. So that underneath all this, this is where you get into 200 years or 300 of the British East India Company.
Right.
That this is their outlook. This isn't just a few people, desperate people going bad into drugs.
Right. This is something that was known going back to the time of Plato and even earlier. It was described as the oligarchical principle, where you have certain leading oligarchical families that believe that the human race is divided into two camps, a very small elite and a vast majority of people to be treated like slaves or beasts of burden, cattle, and nothing better, to be exterminated whenever it suits the needs of this oligarchy. And then you've got a completely different tradition, a Republican humanist tradition that says man is immortal. Not the individual human being, but mankind as a species is immortal because we have the capacity for creative discovery and the ability to put those creative discoveries to use in the form of science and technology that creates better conditions of life, building on past discoveries, building into the future, and that as the result of this, mankind as a whole has the potential, it's not guaranteed, but mankind has the potential to be an immortal species, to be able to survive the great kills that have been the characteristic feature of our solar system, our galaxy, going back hundreds of millions, billions of years, that periodically, through certain cycles, mankind or all species go through an existential crisis. 95% of all species that have existed on this planet are now extinct. But in each of these great kills, the other characteristic is that more advanced forms of life developed, ultimately reaching the point perhaps a couple of million years ago where you had the emergence of man. And, you know, the history of mankind is very new. It's only tens of thousands of years that we have any sense of recorded history. But mankind is evolving, is developing, because of our unique and exclusive capacity to make creative discoveries about the nature of the universe, to develop new technologies through those scientific discoveries. And so man changes as a species in a non-biological way that is absolutely unique to, you know, to the best of our knowledge. There is nothing else that compares to it, at least in our solar system. And, you know, we haven't gotten to do enough traveling about the solar system or the galaxy to be able to know whether there's anything else comparable. There's no reason to assume not, but we just don't know. So mankind is unique in this capacity for immortality. And the oligarchical principle violently rejects that and instead tries to impose absolute limits, slavery on the vast majority of human beings. So we're in an existential moment right now where the two systems are no longer able to coexist.
Right. Funny, I come back to the way you opened your remarks today about the we've had some great blows against the continuation of the Obama presidency, the rejection of Geithner-Yorba and so forth. But bringing around to what you're saying about this oligarchical principle that we have an opportunity to vanquish, they also operate in economics. I mean, the financial bailout side is one thing, but through kind of chokehold, they're oriented to have a whole corporate system through chokeholds on the fossil fuel of our earth, on the water supply, on the food supply, cartelization, globalization. Right. The BP oil spill has its particulars about who didn't do what, but that's right. What BP is about.
Right.
That's what Royal Dutch Shell, who were part of the nexus you expose as selling the oil that the Saudis committed to give in order to get the weapons and help create a slush fund. But so this is an opportunity we have. What you described at the beginning of the program as for what if we have a trio of Russia and China and prospectively the United States could do, we'd have development corridors in the Americas, we'd have development corridors in Eurasia instead. But would you say more about that current, the kind of corporate side or the clash of the two is what we're talking about?
Well, look, we've reached the point, and there's a very specific reason why I said these two systems can no longer coexist.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that we're heading up towards about 7 billion people living on this planet at this point. And in order to maintain that level of population and actually expand it, you have to have a great degree of scientific and technological advancement. You can't stagnate. And in fact, we've already reached the point where to even barely maintain the current levels of population, you have to have a global science driver policy. It's the collaboration between the United States, Russia, and China that begins with this common sense of science driver to allow the world to survive. Russia desperately needs it to gain access to the strategic raw materials and other things that are vital to survival. The Chinese have 1.4 billion people. You've got to keep progressing and introducing more and more of a scientific driver component to the economy. And of course, the U.S. was established on principles, Hamiltonian economics, that are exactly this science driver, infrastructure-driven economic growth. So, needless to say, the oligarchy wants to reduce the world population to 1 billion people to kill science, to kill what it is that makes mankind human, this potential for immortality. And basically, the issue of immortality is on the line right at this moment, and we have the capacity to win that fight, winning it by getting rid of Obama, who's an instrument of the oligarchical principle, getting him removed from office, either under the 25th Amendment or through impeachment, and right away is a precondition. And then we can move ahead with the policies that will revive these Republican ideas of man as an immortal species. And the U.S., China, and Russia are the anchors for accomplishing that. And I think that I can tell you, Mr. LaRouche is very optimistic today that we're on the trajectory to win this fight in the very near term.
Well, that brings us to the end of this discussion. I want to stress very explicitly, people should activate with their wallets, with their time, with their attention to other people. We know what we're wielding in the way of the insistence on Glass-Steagall and these policies. And the tempo of events are very fast. There's a very pivotal election in Berlin. We may be discussing it next week. I think that's on Sunday, which is right. The 18th of September. There are other events. I think there's an occupation of Wall Street going to kick off today.
It's happening as of noon.
Okay.
Thousands of people are there.
Yeah.
I've gotten some preliminary reports.
So be sure and call in or email and so forth, and coordinate, but activate. So I want to thank Jeff Steinberg. This is the conclusion of September 17th, 2011, LaRouche Show. And stay tuned. This is Marcia Mary signing off. Mary Baker, thank you.